I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about a challenge that daunts most families with children, how to pay for college. We talk often about education as an investment in the future. We'll talk about ways to make sure that you're getting the right return on that investment and help you figure out ways to make the investment in the first place. We'll discuss all of this with our guests, Indiana Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lubbers, Ivy Tech Community College President Tom Snyder, and Hamilton Southeastern High School Guidance Counselor Bill Zeller. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today on No Limits about paying for college. We're fortunate to have as our guest today Teresa Lubbers, Indiana Higher Education Commissioner. Teresa, welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, John.
It's good to have you back. Tom Snyder, who is the president of Ivy Tech Community College. Tom, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here on a beautiful day.
It is indeed. Bill Zeller, who is the guidance counselor at Hamilton Southeastern High School. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
And as we talk about education today, we want you to know that WFYI is part of American Graduate, a public media initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help communities address the dropout crisis. The initiative builds on our commitment to education through conversations and partnerships between public radio and television stations and local schools, businesses, and community organizations to help students stay on the right path to a high school diploma. We'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation today by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can also send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter. Okay, so this is a subject I know, since obviously in my other life I spent an awful lot of time talking to college parents and college students, that is a massive source of concern. How big a problem, how big a challenge is this for people in Indiana? Teresa Lubbers, I'll start with you.
Well, let me begin with some sort of sobering numbers to put this in context. Indiana now ranks 8th in the nation in terms of the student debt load. If you look at the student debt load as a nation, it has now passed the $1 trillion mark, passing credit card debt in the country. Indiana ranks 3rd in the nation, ties for 3rd in the nation on the default rate on student loans. Tuition has increased by over 100% in the last decade. 2/3 of our students graduate from college with debt. So for multiple reasons, this is a topic that's of great concern to people.
And how much anxiety, Bill Zeller, in terms of you talking with the students, presumably their parents who are about ready to launch into college careers, how much anxiety does this produce for them?
I think it depends on each student and their situation. It can cause a great deal of anxiety for some. Others are fortunate enough coming from I've worked 13 years at Hamilton Southeastern. There is some affluency in Hamilton County, and we do have some students that don't have that worry. I have others that's all they think about is how they're going to pay for college, how they're going to get there, what they're going to do. And I think a lot of times it's frustrating for them because they've got maybe friends or somebody that isn't worried about it, and that's really consuming them. So it's something we deal with all senior year and even before.
And Tom Snyder, with your students and the people you serve, how big a problem is it for them?
Well, there are support systems for them, and we get a lot of students who rely on Pell because we're the low-cost provider. About 70% of our students are Pell recipients, so we would have, you know, many more times the Pell students. But frankly, Pell isn't.
We probably I know the nomenclature. We probably ought to tell people.
Well, Pell would be named after Senator Pell, and of course that's an important thing to remember as we go forward. What is a Pell grant? Mm-hmm. It's a grant based on family income, and it does not have to be repaid if you stay in school. So it will pay the first $11,000 at Ivy Tech for a 2-year degree, and the first $22,000. Beyond that. So it's actually one of the most important tools that helps our average low-income students.
And I guess before I'm going to start getting into the listener questions, because we've already started getting email questions on this subject, how efficient is our structure here in Indiana at providing necessary support or the necessary inducements to getting students into college and making it an affordable investment for them? I'll start with Tom Snyder. We'll go in reverse order this time.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me start with this and then say, you know, the starting place needs to be with the parent and, you know, with the student, and it has to start really in middle school, if not before. And I'll let Teresa expand on that. And that is, we have a great tool here, the Indiana College Cost .org, which is the website where you can go in and you can estimate the cost. I think that's really important. I think also I would defer to her on 21st Century Scholars, where low-income students who agree to stay drug-free, to stay in school, have great opportunities. So there are many means for more students to take advantage of this than there are today. Getting into college means that you're going to have to make a choice, and I think one of the choices that's going to face more and more students, and that is the residential experience that perhaps most of us went through, is unaffordable for about half the families in Indiana without taking on a lot of debt. That, I think, is the issue we're facing today.
So we're talking about a different concept of what a college education should be. Teresa Lubbers, I think Tom kind of set you up there, so we'll take you next.
Well, he did, and I started by giving some sobering statistics, but I think it's also important to follow up with what both of the other speakers have talked about, which is aid that's available. Indiana is a very a generous state in terms of need-based aid compared to some other states. Some are give a lot of merit aid. We rely on our institutions to provide merit aid, and the state itself provides aid that's based on need. And even in the last couple budget cycles, when there was relatively no money for anything, the legislature actually did put more money into financial aid. It's important for students to know that that money is available to them, and that, for example, the 21st Century Scholar, if you make good on your commitment to stay in school and stay out of trouble and have a decent grade point average, and if you're low income, the state will find a way for you to get to college. Now, that's your tuition. You have living expenses beyond that that you need to factor in. The other thing that I think is important to follow up on is this college cost estimator that we have. Often people see what the sticker shock is of college, and they eliminate certain options thinking that they can't afford it. The college cost estimator allows you to have a comparative tool where you can look at the net cost of college if you do all the things that you need to do to reduce those costs. And so I think providing that kind of good information to students and families is very important going forward in making college decisions.
We are talking about how to pay for college here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to stick with that for a second, Teresa Lubbers, and talk about what are the best-kept secrets in terms of figuring out creative ways to fund a college education here in the state. Suppose I am, 16 years old and there's not a lot of family income or anything like that, and I really want to go to college. Where should I be looking right now?
Well, before you look any place, you should look internally, and you should decide that you're going to work as hard as you can in school to get as good of grades as you possibly can. Make sure you get the academic honors diploma instead of just Core 40, because that will drive more money to you with financial aid. We try to work through Learn More Indiana, which is our communications wing, to make sure that students understand the intersection between being academically and financially prepared. You need to make sure you hit all those deadlines. You know, right now we're bumping up on FAFSA, March 10th, which is the day to fill out your financial aid form. So you need to do that. But long before you get into the mechanics of how you apply for aid, you need to be prepared academically to take advantage of those opportunities.
We've gotten a question, actually, about FAFSA. It's from a listener in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who says, why is it required for a student to submit a FAFSA? That's hard to say. When the scholarship is merit, academic, accomplishment-based, and not financially based. Teresa Lubbers, anybody have an answer? I'll start with you.
Well, obviously, this caller was from Michigan. We, as I mentioned, we're primarily a need-based state, but it's important whether you're getting institutional aid or merit aid that you fill out FAFSA. And it's important that students and families understand that you don't do that one time. You do that every year in order to continue to qualify for it. So in order to know that you're taking advantage of all the opportunities out there, you need to fill your FAFSA form.
Well, and I guess what I want to pick up on a point, we say Indiana's need-based, but it sounds like there's a merit component in there, too, that obviously if you do the academic honors rather than the core 40 and you achieve at a higher level, that can affect even the need-based aid that you receive.
It allows you to get more need-based aid. You're absolutely right.
And what are the differences there in terms of dollars?
You can get 100% if you of the financial aid that's available. And it's obviously based on needs still, so I can't calculate what it would be for an individual student. But if you get the academic honors, you can qualify for 100%. If you only have core 40, you only qualify for 80% of the maximum grant.
Okay. Do we max that out? You know, when we're talking about 100%, what would be 100% of someone who's done superbly well, a valedictorian or whatever, but still has need-based?
Well, if they qualified for all of the need-based it would depend if they were going to a private institution, a public institution, a proprietary institution, or a two-year or four-year. Tom and the proprietary schools are at the lowest level in terms of state aid, what they would get, and then it tears its way up. We're actually pretty agnostic in Indiana based on where you go to school. We actually provide aid to private schools and proprietary schools as well. I can't quote the exact number.
No, I'm looking more for a ballpark,
right,
on this. I mean, but I'm assuming that it's not an open-ended commitment, that you know, it's not a profit-making opportunity for you if you're a student.
No, it is not. The money goes to the school on behalf of the school individual.
Okay. Bill Zeller at Hamilton Southeastern, mm-hmm, with the students that you're working with. What is the most effective tool for helping them afford college?
Well, I'll go back just real quick on your first question about the best kept secret. I think one thing that I'm seeing, and I had just mentioned that to Tom, was more than ever in the last 2 to 3 years, kind of as the economy turned down, we have more and more students going the route of a two-year Ivy Tech situation and looking to transfer after that to IU, Ball State, Purdue, IUPUI, anything along those lines. Ivy Tech has a lot of great arrangements with our state colleges and universities for that. So that is one way to fund your education that wasn't going on 5, 6, 7 years ago. It's happening now, and it's happening at our school more than I've ever seen it. Some of the things that are out there, I guess, another thing I guess I wanted to say in addition to that is, I guess my frustration with the students today, and Teresa kind of touched on that, was, you know, we are helping the kids with a high need, and we're helping the kids that are valedictorians, salutatorians. I'm running into more struggles with the middle of the road. The student with the 3.0 that they have a median income, that's where I'm not, you know, and I'd love to, you know,
the
find out more.
Middle,
I can't find where that aid, you know, where to get that aid for that student. And that's been frustrating from a guidance perspective. You know, to answer that, I'd say that, you know, the FAFSA, definitely. We put on a workshop for our kids in January for the parents. You know, that's a huge piece of it. The merit base, pursue every angle you can through internet scholarship search sites, and then the institution itself. So that's about the only angles you can really to look at to get money.
We are talking about how to afford college here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Boy, my idea is really complex, but I'll try to make it concise and as brief as possible.
Yeah, if you could, please.
Yeah, I would like to sacrifice probably 95% of the billions of dollars in foreign aid that we give away to other countries and turn that inward, whereby you can create a program where a natural-born U.S. citizen can apply to college. I would make a program that's 100% paid for. It's not a student loan. In other words, the government subsidizes the universities to give the kid a free education, base it on household income threshold as well as need. Obviously, if you're an orthopedic surgeon married to an attorney and you're making $300,000 a year, you don't qualify. You can't immigrate here legally from Mexico and then turn around and apply. You would have a lengthy waiting period. But rather than giving the hundreds of billions of dollars away in foreign aid, I would be more selective about who we give our foreign aid to and turn the rest of that inward. So, radical idea, but just wanted to share my 2 cents.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Well, I think probably what we'll do is we will take that up in a second. You are listening to No Limits right now, where we are talking about how to pay for college with our guests, Teresa Lubbers, Bill Zeller, and Tom Snyder. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We're talking today about paying for college with our guests, Indiana Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lubbers, Tom Snyder, who's the president of Ivy Tech Community College, and Bill Zeller, who is a guidance counselor at Hamilton Southeastern High School. Before the break there, we got a call from Mark, who, if I can synthesize this, said that we really ought to reallocate resources here. Instead of spending so much money on foreign aid, we ought to plow it back into making college basically a right here, a college education a right, funding it. He'd put some exclusions there. I think I'm being fair to Mark's argument there. If I missed it, if one of you heard something that I didn't, please correct me. What do you think of that idea, Teresa Lubbers?
Since none of the three of us will have anything to do with the decision about how to spend federal dollars on foreign aid, I would say this, that if you look at states like California and their movement toward really essentially being able to have community college almost free, and then look at the situation they're in now in terms of what's happening with their budget in California. It's sort of a promise that they're not able to make good on right now. Likewise, if you look at a state like Georgia that had the Hope Scholarship based on merit aid, where everyone would be allowed to go to college, they no longer can afford the Hope Scholarship there, and so they're now having to retract on that promise. So I think it is important to look at ways to make sure that students can afford to go to college. And I talk about this in terms of a shared responsibility. I talked about what students can do to make sure they're prepared to get there. And then there are things that they need to do when they get there. They need to take 15 credit hours a semester if they can, if they want to graduate on time. And their financial aid is going to run out after 8 semesters. And so if they don't graduate on time, they're going to run out of money. Likewise, I think the institutions have an obligation to meet the needs and develop a student-centric system that recognizes that students look very different than they used to, as Tom has mentioned, and we need to provide higher education options that meet the needs of students so that they can complete on time. Haven't answered exactly his question, but it's probably one that we're not able to really deal with in totality.
Well, let me reframe it then a little bit, because I think part of what the jump-off, he used foreign aid because that's a huge pot of money, I would guess. But his argument was that it, to some degree, this should be a right, a college education that you can't survive, thrive in today's world without it. And actually, that even that argument has come into question in the presidential campaign. We've had a presidential candidate who sort of argued that college is not necessary. Are there other ways we could approach this relationship? Could we say, for example, that yes, we'll allow you to go to college if you agree to paying, you know, a higher tax rate for the 10 years in which you follow it, or something like that? Some other way that we could approach this? Tom Snyder, I'm going to pass.
I think the issue is that actually the and I don't have the exact numbers, but we spend $30 billion on Pell, which is a grant. We have a loan program that's over $100 billion. So I think the resources are there to do that. Whether there should be more or not, I think it's an issue that we have to face in this era of deficits. And the bigger issue is that costs have risen twice the cost of inflation, and they're really hard to roll back. So you take a student at Hamilton Southeastern or Manual or Tech and say, the family make enough to go to college. Or say it the other way, they make too much to get grants and they can only borrow money. What are they going to do? I think that's the issue that we have to face today, and that is really 75% of the students are not in a residential experience, which is cost equal to tuition in many cases. What are the choices? You know, I've been going around to my conversations at Rotary groups and saying, okay, the plan is start locally and maybe transfer, or start locally and stay locally. To give you specific numbers, I took the college cost of IUPUI for 2 years and the college cost of Ivy Tech for 2 years, a very popular option here in central Indiana, and the cost is $22,700 for 4 years of tuition. Can you live at home? Does it cost? It certainly does, but your Pell grant would be $22,200. It means you can start to cover your cost if you get Pell, but if you have to borrow money, then you're borrowing $25,000 instead of the $50,000 to $100,000 it'd take at residential. That really is more common. than what we think. And that's why the growth, not just at Ivy Tech, but the growth of the regional campuses, particularly IUPUI, have exploded.
I think it's important to mention, too, that if you have financial need and you're a 21st century scholar, there is a way to get to college.
We are talking about how to pay for college here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We've gotten a question from a listener who says, what impact has federal funding had on the overall costs of higher education? Teresa Lubbers, you're nodding your head.
Well, there's a lot that's been written about the fact that when you have, when financial aid is more available, it just the costs just keep going up with the financial aid that's available. And I think that there is an inherent risk in funding, having this funding of a system that is reliant on more and more financial aid being available, and then the tendency to then think about that's going to be pushed off on the operating cost of the institution. So I do think we have to be very aware of that, and as you look at the cost structure of higher education. I always say, if you right now, if you Google these four words, is college worth it? You will spend the rest of the week reading articles that will tell you all the reasons why college is worth it, but then will bring into question the value of certain models of higher education. And that's why we're having a very different discussion now about higher education delivery than we did a decade ago.
We are talking about how to pay for college. We've gotten an email question from a listener named Julian who says, I have a 17-year-old heading for college. I'm 68 and retired. My wife works full time. As parenthetically says, I'm either a great schemer or she is a bit younger than I. As a retiree, are there any benefits I can access as far as reporting my income, Social Security and pension? What about 401ks and IRAs? Cheers, Julian. Tom Snyder, you're shaking your head from side to side.
I don't think that there is any particular, some of this is not counted. The idea is to fill out a financial aid form, a FAFSA, and run it through any one of the colleges, ourselves included, and see just what that does. See a financial aid counselor. If you've got a 17-year-old, I wasn't quite sure, you're either on your way to college in the fall or on your way a year and a half from now. But in any case, it's quite soon, and it's none too soon to prepare. I think the other thing that we would want to start have parents to think about, and the students themselves, and that is, and we're mostly talking with people that are coming out of high school, and that is, you don't have to do this all at once. There are certifications that are 1 year, there are associate degrees that are 2 years that outpay many of the four-year degrees, and if you decide that you have something that you're passionate about, it still can get you into the job market where you have escaped this long-term debt, particularly if you're unclear what a four-year degree would do for you. I said before, 25% are residential traditional students, 75% are doing something, including the for-profit schools that are in this area, which, when you consider the cost of room and board, are no more expensive than a residential experience. So I think you have to say, what is the student passionate about? It comes back to Teresa's comment. Mm-hmm. You're only going to do well in the things that you want to do. And then let that drive you to that school and let the school tell you what they can do. There are inexpensive means of getting your degrees.
I've got a good friend who's a financial planner who has made this argument a few times because she knows I'm in the higher ed world, that, in terms of devoting college loans or making people eligible for college loans, we really ought to take into consideration what they plan to do professionally. That, loaning someone who is going to be in a low-income profession $100,000 to get through college is just adding a crushing weight to that person coming out. Maybe not so much if it's going to be someone who's doing specialized surgery or whatever and is likely to be earning a lot going forward. Is that something we should be thinking about, Teresa Lubbers?
I think it's something that we need to be thinking about in terms of making sure that students and families understand what the return on investment will be in having these discussions about value. Certainly, many of us make decisions. I was an undergraduate English major, and if you were going to crosswalk what I might make with my first job compared to that degree, you might bring that into question. And so you think about, with the degree that you get, what's the likelihood that you're going to need to continue to go to school or you're going to be working outside of your field? What are the workforce needs? And what we're really committed to doing is not telling people what they have to do, but making sure they're smart about the decisions that they make and they understand the implications that come for that with debt. So we can start to figure out, if you have certain degrees, what your likelihood of being employed and what the average salary would be in that area. And I think students deserve to know that, knowing that we can nudge people to where we think they're most likely to be successful, but that's an individual decision at some point.
Well, and Bill Zeller, I feel like I'd be remiss to the other side of this argument or this discussion if I didn't say, is there another argument for a college education other than career preparation? Is there some other reason that people should be going to college?
Beyond careers, yeah. I mean, I've always believed in college as a maturity issue, you know, growing up. Those are big years from 18 to 22. I mean, that's what I think frustrates me, that they can't always have that residential experience. So I think that's a big piece of college, is getting away from mom and dad, making decisions on your own, being responsible, learning to show up on time. All those things also go into a career. And I think that's part of being on your own, is living on your own. And I think those kids do grow up a little bit quicker. And I think it can have the reverse effect if you stay at mom and dad's, you know, and you're living in their basement for 4 more years. It's just the truth. But the fact of the matter is, you have to make those sacrifices now if you want to get to that college, you know, get that BS or BA degree. There's no other way to look at it.
We are talking about how to pay for college here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, and thanks for another good program.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. Your question, please.
Yeah, well, it's really more of a comment and a resource for people. We have a daughter who's a senior, and we're right in the middle of this right now. And of the resources I found, there's a terrific one specific to Indiana called the Indiana College Cost Estimator. It's a group based out of Greencastle. A man named Dave Murray heads it up, and his lovers may be familiar with the group because I think they actually have a license from the Indiana Higher Education Commission. But they have a website, and they offer personalized service to families who are looking for financial aid resources and just trying to understand the process. And I'm pretty familiar with the whole college landscape, and this group of people and this resource is just excellent. So if families do an internet search or individuals for the Indiana College Cost Estimator, it's just it's a really terrific free service.
Well, thank you for the call, Michelle. I appreciate it. Teresa Lubbers, you were practically doing a dance there when she mentioned the Indiana College Cost Estimator.
Well, we've only been live with this for less than a year, and so it's clear that people are starting to use it. I also use this as an opportunity to talk about the fact that when we're looking at our efforts focused not just on the 18-year-old student who comes out of high school, but also, you know, we have 800,000 adults who need more education. We have the adults that are going to the community college, and finding them and getting information to them is a whole different track, but a pathway that we're very committed to as well. We can't get to where we need to be in terms of increasing the educational attainment of Hoosiers in Indiana without the active participation of adults in our system as well.
Are there ways we could make this whole process a little simpler? I mean, as I'm listening to this, and obviously I move in this world too, but I try to step back and think of myself as someone who was encountering this, probably as many of Bill Zeller's students and families do, without having a whole lot of background, just this notion that it's out there, and the idea that you've got to go to a resource center or a counselor, that we can't make this process simple enough for people to be able to figure it out on their own, may strike a chord. Tom Snyder, you're nodding your head emphatically. Here.
Well, I think this was one of the initiatives that came out of the meeting of the 10 presidents that met President Obama. I think what shocked the administration, what shocked both sides of the aisle, is this USA Today article that Teresa mentioned, $1 trillion of debt, and realizing if we're going to catch up with Canada and Korea, we got to get more people, adults and college graduates, to go to school. And college is way too complicated. When I'm explaining this to people, I liken college to leasing a car with a couple of small exceptions. You don't know how long the lease is. You don't know the monthly charges, and the surcharges are not written down in front of you. And actually, with the college cost estimator, there's some of that also. So there is a move afoot, and how it'll end up, where the total sticker price plus the side numbers are going to have to be exposed to all the students, and then they have to make a decision. When the residential cost in Indiana, the sticker price is $72,000 parents hadn't thought about that. And my personal experience is that I sent four kids to IU and Purdue, respectively, and I still had a 401k intact. My children now have 10 grandchildren. The cost of those 10 grandchildren for someone is close to $1 million. So it's really changed. And so even successful families, you know, who have children, $100,000 per child, they're going to have to rethink the mission and find ways of getting them to their dream in life differently than in life past.
Well, let me pick this up, and I probably ought to clarify the college cost administrator service that is the IndianaCollegeCost.org.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Yeah, estimator is the same thing you were referring
yes,
to.
Yes, it earlier. Is. Dave Murray, it was sort of the mastermind behind this, but he worked with the commission, mm-hmm. and so we worked with the institutions to actually provide all this information.
And since people are listening, and obviously they care a great deal about this question, you want to give the URL one more time so that they can find it.
You can either go to the commission's website, or you can go to the Indiana College Cost Estimator, or you can go to Learn More Indiana. Any of those will get you there.
Get you there. And, well, just give them one URL here that would
go to Learn More Indiana.
LearnMoreIndiana.org. .org. Okay. And Teresa, all spelled out? Yeah, Bill Zeller.
A question for her just to clarify, because I know it's something we've talked about in our office. But is it mandated that each Indiana institution puts that on their website, the college cost, a link to the college cost estimator?
It is. It's actually national.
So they can get there from any of
the federal government mandated that each college and university mm-hmm. have a net cost calculator. What we have done is provide a comparative tool. Like if you went to IU's, you would only see IU's. Okay. If you go to ours, you could put in three different institutions and compare.
Mm-hmm. And it's great because there are only two states, Texas and Indiana, that have one that's state-centric. And I think that's why it's really valuable, because that way the folks can understand it.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Nancy, her argument's pretty complex, so I'm going to try to boil it down here. But really is arguing that there shouldn't just be a state solution to this problem, that many of these things are regional. She talks about establishing in-state tuition for out-of-state students by recognizing tuition reciprocity, and says that Wisconsin and Minnesota have done something similar.
Right. We do
to
that
this.
Today.
You do? Okay.
Right. So there's reciprocity. If you're on one of the border states, it's a little bit more complicated with Michigan, but certainly the community colleges are encouraging the free flow of students across the border. And now that we're moving to a different kind of funding where the state's not paying for students as they come in the door, we think it's going to be more common to just let students go where they want and be charged local in-state rates. Now, this is community colleges. I think the residential research campuses have a different mission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to be unlikely that University of Illinois or Colorado or big research campuses, including our own, mm-hmm. are going to have in-state for out-of-state students because of capacity.
We do have some, because we participate in the Midwestern Higher Education Compact with 12 states. So there is some reciprocity through that. But clearly we're seeing more reciprocity around the borders.
We are talking about how to pay for college here on No Limits. We're fortunate to have as our guests Teresa Lubbers, Bill Zeller, and Tom Snyder. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism and executive editor of thestatehousefile.com. We are talking today about how to afford college. We're fortunate to have as our guest Teresa Lubbers, who is Indiana State Higher Education Commissioner, Bill Zeller, who is a high school guidance counselor at Hamilton Southeastern High School, and Tom Snyder, who is the president of Ivy Tech Community College. You can join this conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Sally, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, Sally. Welcome to the program.
Thank Thank you. I just wanted to comment on the discussion a few minutes ago about the value of education.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's difficult, maybe impossible, to actually measure the return, I think we sometimes miss the fact that being educated, even if, you know, heaven forbid you end up in a minimum wage job, still makes you more likely to be socially responsible, to be an informed citizen and a productive contributor to society. So there are those parts of education besides just return on investment, even besides maturing from the residential experience, that there's just an inherent value in becoming a college-educated person.
Meeting the responsibilities of citizenship, really, as a in a self-governing society. Is that sort of what you're arguing, Sally?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly what I meant.
Well, thank you for that comment. I think we will kick that around a little bit. Thanks for the call, Sally. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, do we miss this because we focus so much on the career aspects of education that we don't talk as much about the other parts of it? That, to some degree, her argument was a Jeffersonian one, which is that, you know, you have to be prepared to assume the responsibilities of citizenship. That's the other obligation that education has. Teresa Lubbers, do we talk enough about that?
Well, I certainly agree with her, and I think it's borne out in when you look at quality of life issues for communities and individuals that education matters. So I think these are not mutually exclusive discussions. It's not as if we have to have one or the other, because we want to make sure that people have the opportunities to take care of themselves and their families and can be gainfully employed and improving the economy of our state. By the same token, we know that when they do that, they're more likely to be involved in their communities, they're more likely to be involved in the political system, they're more likely to be contributors to not-for-profits. So there are all kinds of reasons why quality of life. And, you know, and if you want to look at it from the other standpoint, too, the unemployment rate for college graduates right now is certainly higher than it's ever been, but it's still half of what a high school graduate has. So there are all kinds of compelling reasons why higher education matters. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to have the discussion about value and productivity as well.
Tom Snyder, I see you leaning in. You must have a point you want to make.
No, I would just reinforce that. I think what Bill sees every day at the high school, and that is, when you have a high school with a high college going rate, it reinforces one another. And what we have to do is spread what goes on at Hamilton Southeastern to high schools and middle schools throughout the state so that that their biggest worry is how am I going to get there and how am I going to pay for it, as opposed to the fact, hey, maybe I shouldn't go.
We are talking about education today here on No Limits. And as we talk about education, we want you to know that WFYI is part of American Graduate, a public media initiative funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to help communities address the dropout crisis. The initiative builds on our commitment to education through conversations and partnerships between public radio and television stations and local schools, businesses, and community organizations to help students stay on the path to a high school diploma. We've gotten an email question from a listener taking issue with one of our other listeners. And to make things even more confusing, they're both named Mark, but we'll work through it. Says a caller suggested redirecting the hundreds of billions of dollars the U.S. spends on foreign aid to meet pressing needs in the U.S., including higher ed. Without getting into the merits of the idea, it is important to be clear on how much the U.S. actually spends on foreign non-military aid. The primary method through which the U.S. distributes foreign aid is the U.S. Agency for International Development, a part of the State Department. The total amount requested for fiscal year 2013 is $51.6 billion, or 1% of the total U.S. federal budget. Certainly not chump change, but spending on foreign aid is far less than many people believe. While the U.S. spends the largest amount of total dollars in terms of a share of the gross national income, the U.S. is far down the donor list. So that's from another Mark, and he just wanted to make that point. We've gotten a question from a listener named Nancy, who says the 21st Century Scholars Program eligibility question. Isn't eligibility determined when you sign up in eighth grade? Given the plummeting incomes of many middle-class families, has the legislature revised eligibility to permit participation by students who are the nouveau poor? If in 2008 your parents lost employment and you are now in the group of free and reduced lunch kids, can you enter the 21st Century Scholars Program later than the 8th grade. Teresa Lubbers.
Well, there were several changes made in the scholarship program last year, and so let me approach this from two different angles. One, you do sign up in 7th or 8th grade. It used to be 6th, 7th, or 8th. Now it's 7th or 8th grade when you sign up. And the reason why you have to sign up and you can't sign up in your junior year is because this is meant to be an aspirational preparation program. So there are other scholarships, certainly the Frank O'Bannon Scholar, and other scholarships are available to students whose families fall into a need later. But that program is based on academic preparation as well as financial need. The other issue is that we are now, because of the strains on the system and so many people who have signed up to be scholars and the inability to make good on that, they did revise it so that there has to be some need at the time of graduation from high school as well.
So just to sort of frame that listener's question more specifically, suppose you are, you know, you in a comfortable lifestyle in the eighth grade, and then one or both of your parents lose their jobs. You've performed well academically, but you find yourself suddenly, as a junior, you know, you would have qualified if you could roll back time, but don't now. What's the best option for you?
Well, you still may qualify for the maximum Frank O'Bannon scholarship. You won't be able to qualify for the 21st century scholarship program.
And is there a difference in the amounts of aid there, or is that?
Depending on what your financial need, it's tiered based on your need, but the maximum Frank O'Bannon may not be 4 year in the same way the 21st century is. I'm not sure if it's exactly the same amount, but you would certainly qualify for the maximum Frank O'Bannon, which would be a significant amount of money.
We are talking about how to pay for college here on No Limits. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Great program as always.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thanks
your
for
question,
taking
please.
My call.
Thank you.
Sure. There are two things that I would have thought helpful to know when my daughters first entered high school. One is that if they achieve a certain ACT or SAT score and a GPA, they might get their tuition paid by IU, Purdue, or Ball State. And the second item is that if they stay in school and don't graduate early, as one of them wanted to do, they can earn college credit through an ECP-type program, which is essentially a college class taught by an IU-certified professor, and they get actual college credit. And my daughter is already a sophomore, even though she's in her first year at IU.
Well, and we talked about that a bit during one of the breaks about the idea really of dual enrollment and the ways that you can kind of accelerate your college education. Bill Zeller, how common is that at Hamilton South?
Extremely. We have probably 75% to 80% of our seniors that at least take one AP class or an ACP class. And the caller is correct. That is, those are classes taught by IU and they're offered to our seniors. Some junior classes also available there. But, you know, that's one way to go about it is, you know, explore the AP classes at your school. They're not going to be for everybody. Just because you take the class doesn't mean you're going to get the credit. It's all based on your exam score. But that is a way to earn 15 to 30 hours. We have some students going off close to 30 hours of college credit. Yes, they are probably our top 5 or 10% academically, but there are some others that got, you know, that have 6 to 12 hours to just help kind of lighten their load, take the, you know, ease off the financial burden a little bit. We also have some, you know, there's some dual credit agreements going around the state right now as well. We've got a program with Ball State in place. We've got a couple with Ivy Tech, Vincennes, Purdue, where they take the class for reduced cost, still $300 to $400, but it's still much less than if you took it on campus. So I agree with them.
Are there other ways that we could maximize the redefine kind of the relationship or the transition from high school to college to make it a little more efficient and therefore a little less costly for parents? Teresa Lubbers?
We're looking a lot at the senior year of high school and even the junior year, but especially the senior year of high school, to see what that means in terms of the transition to college and how you actually enter college with credits as you begin. And we're doing that much more successfully. I will indicate that the commission is very committed to academic rigor in these classes as well, and to ensure that students, when they enter college, are actually prepared to do the work in the next course that they would take. We think that good dual credit, and certainly AP, can do that.
We are talking about the high cost of college education here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Paul, welcome to the program. Paul, welcome to the program. It looks like we lost him. Well, we're talking about this. Are there other ways that we ought to sort of revolutionize the idea that college, I mean, obviously, we've had this debate for a long time in Indiana about the calendar itself. I mean, part of the reason college takes 4 years is because we give everybody the summer off. Is that a notion that needs to go by the wayside?
And it is. Even mm-hmm. as we speak, you now have several of our institutions that are looking at more balanced calendars. We saw some of this happen in the K-12 system, but you're starting to see it at higher ed as well, offering lower tuition for the summer, moving toward Purdue, anticipating having 3 full trimesters. So the idea that this agrarian economy and of the state needs to still, that the school needs to have a calendar that matches that is just not true anymore, that we need to make it possible for students to go to school in a condensed period of time. If they want to go, you know, 3 semesters and finish in a shorter period of time, that should be an option. So I think the balanced calendar is the way to go.
Tom Snyder, does that make sense to you?
Well, the community college is year-round anyway. It's 24/7 because about half the students are also taking the course online. So, number one, online is an opportunity. Number two is all students in the state of Indiana can take summer courses at their community college and transfer most of them back to their home. And we've done a couple of innovative things. We started a program called ASAP, which takes free and reduced lunch students recommended by their principal or their guidance counselor, and they start in August, and they do 5 8-week semesters and graduate with a 2-year degree in 12 months, and then can go on and transfer. Virtually all of them are transfer students. So I think the colleges are starting to look at that. I think we just have to remind ourselves that this thing got away from us. I think U.S. News and World Report kind of effect said, hey, the more you charge, the more elite you are. And it turns out when half the K-12 families are free and reduced lunch, we're leaving people behind with the current cost. It's inexcusable, and we're just now facing up to that problem. There are lots of ways to help, but first of all, we have to recognize we've got a problem.
Paul, welcome back to the program. Sorry, that one was my fault. I hit the wrong button last time.
That's all right. My question is regarding students who are independent from their parents, but through filing the FAFSA, they have to include their parents' financial information, and that affects their aid eligibility. What comments or suggestions do you have to help reduce the burden on those students?
There is a group of students, if I jump in, John,
Please, Tom, that
are under the age of 24 that really have no parental support. In fact, we have cases where the parents refuse to give them their tax return. I'd say that student needs to go in to see a guidance counselor and a financial aid advisor on a campus and see what the opportunities are. You can appeal for emancipation, and a financial aid office can help a young person do that. Sadly, it's not so uncommon today that you have to go through that process. But there is a way to get yourself out from under a parent's tax return, especially when you can't get the return from them.
We are talking about higher education here on No Limits. Josh, welcome to the program.
Howdy.
Hey, your question. We're running up on time here, so
if
you could be concise.
Real brief. I just want to get the panel's views very briefly about the recent voting process coming up on the House bill about the quarter credit hour definition that the Department of Education is looking at, how that whole gainful employment and quarter credit hour definition affects the educational industry.
Good question. Thank you, Josh. Teresa Lubbers, I think I'll start with you on that one first. We probably ought to explain what the bill is real quick.
Well, if I'm speaking of the same thing that he is speaking of, there's legislation that actually passed out of the House right now, which looks at authorization and redefining what the credit hour might mean. I think that both of those, it looks at right now, the authorization process that's taking place has become increasingly cumbersome, and they're trying to simplify it. It doesn't appear at this point that there may be the votes in the Senate to do that, but I think that will not stop the discussion about what is a credit hour, and how does that then match up to financial aid and how we provide financial aid and how that looks when you have these new systems, when you have semesters looking different, credit hours looking different. We have to have a system that acknowledges those changes as we move forward.
Well, and I would presume part of it, too, is you want to preserve room for innovation and a certain different approaches to education as well.
You do. And the real key to this whole thing will be the accreditors. It really is the Higher Learning Commission and the accreditors and how they choose to deal with the credit hour issue, too.
We've had a lively discussion here about the challenge of paying for college on No Limits. I am grateful to all of my guests here. I'd like to thank Teresa Lubbers for joining us. Teresa, it was a pleasure talking with you again, as always. Bill Zeller, thank you very much for joining us from Hamilton Southeastern High School, home of some of my favorite students over the years. Bill,
mine
it was
too.
A pleasure having you here. Tom Snyder from Ivy Tech Community College, thank you for being with us today.
Great topic, great conversation.
Well, I think actually we should have done 2 hours on this one, and we will have you all back so that we can continue it. I'd like to apologize to all the listeners that we weren't able to get into the program. I promise we will do this subject again, and we will try to get you in at that point. I also would like to invite you to join us for a special broadcast on Monday when we will be doing a one-on-one show with retiring Indiana Chief Justice Randall Shepard. Same time, 1 o'clock on Thursday, and then on Monday, excuse me. And then next Thursday, we will be talking about Randy Shepard's legacy as Chief Justice with 2 special guests. I am John Kroll. Thank you for spending this time with us. We'll talk with you next week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org. We'll be right back.